Hi, I'm Juliette Mayers. Welcome to Entering the Inspiration Zone with Juliette Mayers, a podcast for business professionals and entrepreneurs seeking positive connection and professional development. As an accomplished author, speaker, DEI strategist, and member of Forbes Coaches Council, I am living the dream, and I love helping others achieve their dreams. Each episode, I will share with you actionable steps that you can take to build the work and life you've imagined. Welcome. So excited to have with me today, Colette Phillips. Colette is the CEO and president of Colette Phillips Communications, Inc. She is a culture change catalyst, DEI pioneer, thought leader, innovator, practical visionary, influencer, PR maven, and super uber duber connector. Those are my words. Colette, welcome to the podcast.
I am delighted to be on your podcast and congratulations on what is a growing following and successful podcast.
Thank you. Thank you so much. A few more things I want to highlight to our listeners who may not know you. In addition to all of these wonderful things that I just mentioned, you're also the president of the GK Fund. So this is philanthropic arm as well. And one of the creators of All Inclusive Boston, which was a collaboration with Proverb Agency and the Greater Boston Convention Bureau. There are many, many other things that I could say, but one thing I do want to highlight too are some of the amazing accolades that you have. There are too many for us to go into, but just to name a few, that you are the recipient of the Pinnacle Award from the Greater Boston Chamber of Commerce, an award from the Massachusetts Women's Political Caucus, the Abigail Adams Award, the American Jewish Committee, and many, many more, which our listeners will have an opportunity to see in the show notes. And you are the author of The Includers, the 7 Traits of Culturally Savvy Anti-Racist Leaders, which we will be talking more about. So thank you, Colette, for joining me again. And we're going to jump right in. So the first question I ask all of my guests is to help our listeners understand who you are. Tell us about your journey.
Well, I grew up on an island in the Caribbean, Antigua. And as you know, as someone from the Caribbean, you know, the issue of race and diversity was not an issue because most of the people who lived on the island that I grew up on looked like me. So I never really thought of race or my skin color. It was just a given. And we didn't have, thankfully, the same issues that in America, you know, the Jim Crowism and all of the restrictions for Black people. I mean, there were issues of class, and certainly there were also issues back in the early 50s and 60s in the islands where people who worked in banks and in the offices and whatnot had to look a particular way. But you never had the real, I would say, harsh impact of race and racism to deal with. All of the people I grew up with, my father's friends, were very successful, either entrepreneurs, doctors, lawyers, the chief of police, the governor general, the prime minister. All of these were people my father knew, my parents knew. So these were the folks I got to interact with. And so I grew up literally without thinking that anything I wanted to do and be, I couldn't. So that was my background. I went to an all-girls private school, and which I thought was good. I think for girls, it's a good thing because you are not distracted by boys in the classroom. And so you got to interact with your peers, and you also had the same take that as a girl and as a woman, there was nothing you couldn't do or accomplish, you know, because you didn't have boys taking away the attention of the teacher in the classroom. So that was good.
Yeah, I certainly can relate to, you know, being a Barbadian myself and that same dynamic, right, of being the majority and coming to the U.S. and having a different experience and perspective. And at the same time, you took it to another level in terms of taking your personal experience and translating that into helping people to really be a catalyst for change when it comes to DEI. And of course, as you and I have known each other for a long time, that's certainly a huge part of my business. And you were one of the early pioneers right there. So tell us about how you took that experience and what shaped your thinking around helping to influence companies and organizations around DEI.
Thank you for that question. That's a great question. I will say that when I came to America and after I graduated, I actually went back to Antigua. I worked in television as a journalist. I had a talk show. So in some ways, you might say I was the Oprah Winfrey of Antigua. I had a talk show called Let's Talk. And it wasn't daily. It was a weekly show in the evenings. And people would watch it and send in suggestions. And I came back to Boston, as somebody would say, you're a glutton for punishment. You didn't have enough. And I came back to do my master's. And growing up in a household where both my parents were entrepreneurs, the entrepreneur, I would say, sting was in my blood. So I decided that I would, having worked in both the telecommunications, nonprofit, and hospitality industries, that I would start my own consulting firm. And I did so. And one of the things that I thought would differentiate me from my competitors, all of whom were white, was the fact that I brought a broad perspective to the communications, the marketing, the public relations lens. I brought that lens to my clients, and I decided I was going to help clients recognize that they were leaving significant dollars on the table by not having Black, at the time we didn't say Black and Brown or BIPOC, we said ethnic groups, minority groups in their marketing mix. And particularly for people in the financial service industry, banks, you know, in the healthcare field, both insurance companies, health providers, hospitals, community health centers, and retailers like Reebok and Jordan Marsh, and at the time, now Macy's, to really help those companies understand, look, you know, Black and Brown and Asian people buy clothes, they buy shoes, they buy milk, they buy flour, sugar. So you need to be speaking to them in a way that resonates with those communities. And if English is not your first language, you need to be able to communicate with your consumers in their language, and that you should also be thinking about what types of foods, what types of products that you can have within your, whether it's services like a bank or a retailer like Shaw's Supermarket, who was a client of mine, what types of foods you need to have in your supermarket that would appeal to Caribbean people, to Hispanic consumers and Asian consumers.
Yeah, and I remember those were the early days because you and I crossed paths on the financial services and where redlining was still a huge, huge issue. So it was great to have that addressed given the challenges at the time. So I'm going to switch gears a little bit because you are such a, as I mentioned at the beginning, Uber connector, and anybody who is in certainly the New England region knows about Get Connected, and I'm sure and beyond at this point. So tell us about Get Connected, which is, for those of you who don't know, is a major networking, multicultural networking. I almost don't want to say event because it's beyond an event, but go ahead and describe it.
Well, I think you have it right. Get Connected does three things, really. It's a trifecta. Number one, it's an opportunity to give people of all cultural backgrounds, but in particular, people of color, an opportunity to connect inter and intraculturally, and then for people who are not people of color to connect cross-culturally. So it's really about connections, because I believe very strongly, one, your network is your net worth. And number two, that people do business with people they know, people they like, and people they feel add value, and people they have a relationship with. And you're not going to get that on LinkedIn, on Facebook, on Instagram, on TikTok, or on Twitter, now X. You're going to get that by meeting people face to face. And I don't care what anybody says, that yes, I'm not saying that those social platforms are not important. They certainly can open doors for you. But what is even more important is the opportunity to meet somebody face to face. So that's one of the aspects. The second is to really create a space, because when I started Get Connected 16 years ago, if you can believe that, Juliet, I went to a lot of events where often I was maybe one of five people of color in the room. And I'm thinking to myself, where are the people of color that I know? I mean, there's so many very highly accomplished professional people who shouldn't be in this room. And I figured out that they weren't on anybody's, now we call them Outlook contacts, but back then it was their Rolodex or their database. So I thought, you know what? I know a lot of people just from the work that I did in my past before I started my business. I worked with the Asian community. I worked with the Latino community. I worked with the Black and the Caribbean community and the women's community. So I said to myself, you know what? I'm going to just do this event. And I want to have a programmatic aspect. So you come, you spend the first hour networking, getting to know people, and then take maybe a half an hour or 45 minutes out of that 2 hour, 2.5 hour span and give people something they can walk away with other than five new people that they didn't know and some business cards. Give them, if you're a business person, give them information that can help to enhance their business or their careers. So that was one aspect. And the third was to make Boston and Boston corporate community much more welcoming to people. That if you came in from out of another state or country or out of Mars and you heard Boston was not a friendly place, you could come to Get Connected and really feel the vibes of people just welcoming you. And it didn't matter what you looked like or who you were. People were warm and friendly and welcoming.
Yeah, and still are. I'm fortunate to have been there in the early
days.
Yes,
and you were an early adopter. And I have to say that when you were working with Blue Cross and Blue Shield, heading up their multicultural marketing program, that you actually helped Blue Cross Blue Shield become a founding corporate partner of Get Connected. And they still are, 16 years later, they're still supporting Get Connected. And that started with you, Juliet. So I am eternally grateful and just thrilled that you were an early adopter. You understood very early.
Well, I saw the vision, and you and I have had many, many conversations about networking, given our overlap, but support for.
Right. And I would say that one of the things that you did in, you were launching for Blue Cross Blue Shield, I'll always remember this, a new website that would appeal to people of color, to BIPOC consumers of healthcare. And we decided we were going to set up computers, Get Connected, and that we would have people go on to the computer and experience your website. And I remember you did some research, and that evening following, you had over 75% increase in clicks and visits to the site, which demonstrated.
And to put this in context, this was way back in the day, right? So this was.
That's right.
Today, it would not seem like a big deal. But
I know. This was 2010 or 2011.
So thank you for that. You know, the other thing, and I want to pivot to talk about your fabulous book, The Includers, in a minute. But the other thing I want to highlight is a lot of those connections led to really business leaders and people who were often overlooked and not visible being seen. So thank you for that.
Yeah. And I think the other thing I did not mention about Get Connected, in 2016, we started putting together a series of lists by industry, really to amplify, elevate, and recognize the contributions that people of color were making to the business, to the civic, to the social and economic fabric of both Greater Boston and the Commonwealth, and to highlight people that were out there. I call them Boston's hidden figures. And we started with the first list of the 100 most influential people of color, ended up being list of 185 people, because we did 100 people, then we did 25 emerging leaders, and then we also did 50 people who were pioneers in our field. And then the other was, I would say, community under unsung heroes. And so we ended up with a list of 187 people, which was very good. And people were shocked. They were like, oh my goodness, until you see it. So basically what I did was take away the excuse that we can't find any people of color. We don't know where to reach them. Well, here is a list of 187 very highly accomplished people.
Yeah. And to this day, you know, as those lists continue, I think it's very impactful. And having been the recipient of a number of those things, I really think it's important for people to be seen. And thank you for bringing visibility to a lot of people who might otherwise not have been acknowledged or seen. So I want to talk about this book, The Includers. And I had an opportunity to read The Includers, The 7 Traits of Culturally Savvy Anti-Racist Leaders. And so first, congratulations on your second book. And I think that it is interesting because this is the kind of thing you're focused. This, we're talking about white male allyship, right? And the fact of the matter is, when we think about inclusion and talk about diversity, both many people who, like me and other practitioners, oftentimes and too many times, white males are left out of the equation. And so it's fantastic to see that you have taken what are general DEI concepts and applied that to how white males can be effective allies. So we want to talk about that. And why don't we start by first telling our listeners what inspired you to write The Includers?
Well, I will say that as I looked at the whole arc of my career, I recognize that in a lot of ways, the opportunities that came my way, the opportunities that I got, literally came from white male allies. And that I was looking at the whole dynamics of diversity, equity, and inclusion. And it seemed to focus primarily on people of color and women, but it excluded the very people who sat in the seats of power, the spheres of influence. And like it or not, 99% of the times, the people who are, whether it's in government, policy makers, business, sports, entertainment, the arts, the people sitting in the C-suite and in the corner office are white males. And I am a firm believer that if we are going to move the dial on diversity, equity, and inclusion in this country, we cannot do so and exclude white men from the conversation or from the table. It just does not make sense. And I'll tell you, back 10 years ago, exactly this month, I did something that was, I would say, bold, brave, and big. And I was
literally
the first person. Now, everybody, all the women group, the people of color, back then, I decided that I was going to honor 12 men across multiple industries who were working to move the dial on diversity, equity, and inclusion within their sphere of influence, academic, financial service, sports, entertainment, nonprofit, social justice. And it was, to me, quite remarkable, made sense. And I got a lot of pushback from women, from people of color. What do you mean you're only honoring white men? White men don't need to be honored. They don't need to be recognized. And my take on that is, we're not honoring white men because we think that, oh, only white men could solve the problem. We're honoring them because we want others to emulate their behavior. We want others to mimic their behavior. We want others, other white men and white allies, to look at these men and say, wow, they did this. They didn't have to. When you are sitting in a seat of power and privilege, anything that you do that is helpful to people who are underrepresented, people who do not get the opportunity and the access, don't have the opportunity and the access, I take that as a revelation of your character, of your integrity, of your compassion. And so I wanted to do this as an example for other men. And let me tell you what created that award. The report had come out that January from a UMass organization that was called the Commonwealth Compact, which 5 years earlier, they were formed to really have corporate Massachusetts, corporate Boston report out on how they were working to create more inclusion and more diversity in the C-suites. 5 years after that survey and program was launched, the dial had not moved. And I thought about it and said, this is crazy. How could you have people signing a pledge? This is what they're going to do. And then nothing happened. 5 years down the tube, down the path, no movement. And I realized there wasn't any movement because nobody was talking to the people who had the power to make the movement. And so I thought, if we could highlight and shone a spotlight on the white male allies who were actually, some of them, very quietly working behind the scenes to make things happen. People like Bob Rivers, the chairman, CEO of Eastern Bank, a regional bank here in New England. People like Eric Rosengran, who was the architect of, and he did this like maybe 3 years after being recognized, of the Color of Money study that recognized that the income gap between white families and black families in Boston was horrific. And you had people like a guy who worked for Morgan Stanley by the name of Gallagher, was being mentor to young black and brown men, helping them think about maybe a career path in the financial service industry. Something he did, not because he had to, but because he looked around in his company and consistently did not see people who looked differently from him and thought, I need to step out and begin to mentor young brown and black men to tell them there is a path for you if you're interested in going into the financial service industry. We had Dr. Barry Bluestone, who was a professor at Northeastern and did a number of studies, one to show the impact of immigrants in the workforce in Massachusetts, the housing aspect and how a lack of housing impacted. So this was what we did. And so I looked around, and during the pandemic, after George Floyd's death, so many CEOs sort of really had a what I call a racial awakening, recognizing how they have power and influence, and their power and influence and privilege could be leveraged to really begin to make inroads in closing the wealth gap, but also creating more access and inclusivity and opportunity for people who didn't look like them.
It was also a time, of course, everybody was making pronouncements and trying to figure things out.
Exactly.
So I'm not surprised. I want to pick up on the includer and some of the key qualities and behaviors that define what an includer, in terms of one who is a white male ally, what that looks like. So talk to us about that.
Well, I think when I looked at, there are several men in the book, that including the president of the United States, who I really firmly believe is an includer. If you look at his cabinet, the fact that this was a man who had much more experience than Barack Obama when Barack Obama decided to run for president. And he ran and he dropped out because he didn't make it through Super Tuesday. And Barack Obama asked him to be his vice president. And he said yes. Now, he didn't let ego influence him. And he was a very effective vice president to Barack Obama. He did the same thing when he asked Kamala Harris, the first woman, the first person of color, first Black woman, to be his vice president. That was very bold. That spoke to Barack Obama's character. Because if you remember this, Kamala Harris basically criticized him.
You mean to Biden's character?
To Biden's character, mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
She criticized him about the issue of busing and that, you know, and one would have thought ego would say, I don't want her because, you know, look at how she spoke about me. Includers do not allow their ego to override their character. And he was willing to ask her to be, knowing that this was a very brave, bold move on Joe Biden's part. And it had never been done before, recognizing that this woman would be a heartbeat away from being the president should something happen to him. So he's in the book. Mitch Landrieu, who was the former mayor of New Orleans and who basically took down every single Confederate monument that was put up literally 100 years after slavery. And those monuments, you know, I know that there are people in the South who said, oh, we are basically saluting our heritage. Well, I don't think Germans go around putting up statues of Hitler and saying, we are honoring our heritage. That's not a heritage that anybody should be proud of. So he took them down because those monuments were not put up to honor these people. It was put up to intimidate Black people and to basically show and demonstrate who is in charge and who has the power. It was a product of intimidation and in your face, a power move. And he did that. So we looked at all of these things. So character, Prince Harry took on his family and stood up for his Black wife and called out the British press and called out his family. Some people didn't agree with that, but you know what? Once your eyes have been open to the reality of racism, you cannot slink back into the darkness. Like, you cannot unsee what you have seen. So character begets integrity. And integrity is doing the right thing when no one is looking. And that says a lot about inclusive, culturally savvy leaders. So character is the first. The second is cultural intelligence. you have to put yourself in situations where you might be in the minority, where you might feel a little uncomfortable in a room, where you get to experience what people of color experience every day of their lives because they're in the minority. And learning about other people's culture, being curious, asking questions, engaging with your employees who look different from you, choosing to be a sponsor of a woman's or an LGBT or a Black or Latina or disability employee resource group. That's big. That's important. That's how you learn about people. I always say Anthony Bourdain is my cultural icon. He took us to all these places. He sat with people. He ate their food. Never once did he turn his nose up and say, oh, what's that? You know, he was happy to engage. And the third is, of course, communication. Sometimes our body language speaks louder than our words. And you have to be able to understand how you speak to people, what you say to them, that there are things you could say that may come across as a micro or a macro aggression, using terminologies that is basically insulting to people of color.
Right. But a lot of people aren't even aware of this and they're not even conscious. And I have one more question before, but I want you to finish.
It's character, courage, commitment, and certainly connections. One of the people that I thought was an absolute cultural connector, deliberately and intentionally, was again Bob Rivers. Bob Rivers used to show up and still does at almost every Get Connected because he was always meeting new people. And he will tell you that a number of people who ended up on his governance board, he met at Get Connected, including you, Juliet, and Phyllis Barajas, and, you know, a number of people.
Bob is an unusual man and definitely is a super includer for sure.
Collaboration. You have to know how to collaborate across cultural lines, how to collaborate internally with your employees who look a little different than you do, and how to collaborate externally with organizations and institutions that serve and are and work within culturally diverse communities. So I would say, if you were to ask me, what are the three most important ones? They're all important, but the three that I think really ties this all together. Number one is character. The number two, I would say, is courage, because it takes courage, and people need to understand this, and in particular, people like us, people of color, that it takes courage for a white person to really stand up, speak up, and speak out. Because often they become targets. They become targets of haters. They become targets of people who think, well, why is he doing this? So it takes courage. And you can have character. You can have all six traits. But the last and perhaps most important trait is commitment. Nothing happens without your personal commitment. Commitment to change, commitment to being involved, commitment to doing the right thing, commitment to making sure that your organization from the top to the bottom reflects a diverse and inclusive environment, and that you also are willing to create in your company an environment where everyone feels valued, appreciated, and that they belong.
Yeah, I usually add to that because I have seven of almost different, some of the same, but some different ones. And for the commitment one, I always tell people it's important too. The commitment is also shows up in your budget, right? It's like you can have all of the words in the world that haven't allocated the budget. And so those are very powerful, Colette. And we are running up on time. So I'm going to just do a brief summary. And actually, I have one other quick question for you, because I do want to ask you about your vision for the future of where you think there's been so much change with DEI and entire ecosystem around how even allies can show up people are being attacked on all different sides. What's your vision of what might happen in the future? If we can do a quick take on that, and then we'll do our summary.
Well, first of all, DEI is here to stay. We have a changing demographic, fast changing. Blacks, Asian, Latinx are the fastest growing segments of our demographics in this country, and immigrants. And we also need to have a reimagining, a re-engineering, and a rethinking of DEI. On one hand, we have the people who only see DEI through the lenses of gender and race. And on the other hand, we have the people who see DEI as an us versus them approach, the oppressed, the oppressors. Both are wrong. And I'll tell you why. We cannot create an environment in a workplace or in a country or a community with divisiveness, with setting up new biases against any group of people. And we have to also be inclusive of religious minorities, Jews, Muslims, Sikhs, Hindus. People who are religious minorities have to be included in the diversity conversation. My belief is the path to inclusion has got to be radical anti-exclusion. And that's what the Includers is all about. We must include white men in the conversation because we are never going to move the needle as fast as we need to move it. And this is not about white men being white knights on white horses charging in to save women and people of color. This is about white men standing in the breach, being equal, seeing us as equals, and leaning in, listening, learning, and leading from behind. Let the people who have been the most oppressed, the most damaged and hurt by the inequality and the disparities in this country tell you what's the best way you, as a white privileged person with power and influence, can support them. That's how it works.
Thank you. And so just a few quick takeaways. There's so many, but I want to just highlight a few things up. One, certainly we started with the fact that really at the heart of this are your powerful connections and ability to bring people together. And whether it's Get Connected or through direct outreach for people of color, making those cross-cultural opportunities available to people. And also bringing and shining light on people who may otherwise not be seen. So the importance of lists, and that really applies to leaders who may be thinking, what can I do? That's one thing that you can do. People want to be seen. They don't want to be invisible. And so I think that's pretty powerful. You do it through your lists and shining light on others. Certainly any leader can do it through being conscious and shining light on others, making sure they're not invisible. In terms of connections for companies and making sure that you are incorporating DEI into every aspect of your organization, not just in terms of talk, but in terms of actions and being an active ally. In terms of the book, we talked about the importance of, you mentioned how important it is to bring white men into the conversation. And I think that's so important. And I love the fact that not only did you talk about it, but you show people how to do it in your book. And so for those of you who have not yet picked up your copy of The Includers, The 7 Traits of Culturally Savvy and Anti-Racist Leaders, we can only cover a couple of things here, but I encourage you to do it. I read it. I think it's a fantastic read. For I'm a DEI practitioner, so I'm looking at it through a different lens, but certainly for anyone who is looking to really bring about change and have some good examples, you can find it there. The 3 C's, and I'm only going to focus on 3 because I know you have 7 and they're all fabulous. People can read about them, but the ones that you are stressing are character, courage, and commitment. And I added to Colette's commitment because she certainly has demonstrated commitment to this work. But how important it is to support people, not just in what you do, but also allocating time and the money to support them. And I think this idea of reimagining DEI and making making sure that we're including all people in the inclusion. Radical inclusion is very, very important. Nobody wants to be on the outside. Everyone wants to feel like they belong. So let's all commit to really living those principles and learning to be effective allies, and also tasking those of you who have white males in power who are allies. You need to tell them what you need and help them to lead by giving your perspective. So that brings us to the end of our podcast. And Colette, can you tell people how they can reach you?
Well, first, they can buy the book on Amazon. Go on Amazon and get the book. And secondly, you can reach me at either ColettePhillips.com, which is also the site for the book, or cpcglobal.com. So either ColettePhillips.com, one word, ColettePhillips.com, or cpcglobal.com.
And that information will also be in the show notes. So thank you again, Colette, for joining me here on Entering the Inspiration Zone. It's been a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure always connecting with you.
Thank you for joining us on Entering the Inspiration Zone. Until next time, we would love to hear from you. So if you'd like to join our mailing list, please send an email to info@inspirationzonellc.com. That's info@inspirationzonellc.com. And be sure to put podcast in the subject line. Thank you and have a fabulous day.